This is Susan Robb for Teachers for a New Era. Talking with Leonard Marcus, who is one of the most well-known and most requested people probably in the children's book industry for many, many reasons. He's the author of books on the industry and all different aspects of the history of children's literature. His new book that's coming out is called Minders of Make-Believe, and it's an elaborate work on the history of American children's publishing. There's also a 10th anniversary edition of a book called A Caldecott Celebration, talking about the Caldecott Award for Illustration, and also recently had done a book on the history of golden books called Golden Legacy. He's also written on books on famous people in the field, like Ursula Nordstrom, one of the most beloved children's editors. And is often asked to speak and a guest lecturer and judge of children's books all around the world. So Leonard, I can ask you to talk some about these different things. First of all, how did this get started, this whole immersion in, in the entire field?
Okay, well, I was a history major at Yale in the early 70s and in desperate need of a senior paper topic, and had been studying early 19th century American history and was very interested in the essays of Emerson and the writings about America of the French writer Alexis de Tocqueville, both of whom commented on American childhood as being different in a significant way from what European childhood had been like, children in America being more independent-minded and more democratic, in a sense, than the way children had been brought up in past centuries in the old world. And I thought that it would be interesting as a historian to see if there were books written for children at that time in America which you could see a new attitude emerging in the way the author, who was an adult, was speaking to the reader, who was a child. So I went to the library, and it turned out, even though no courses on children's literature were being offered anywhere at the university, the library had a huge collection of children's books from that period. So I began reading them, and even though they weren't very interesting as literature, and in a way that was lucky, because it was clear what they were about was ideas and attitudes towards childhood, and those were all the more transparent because there was no great story in the way to make it harder to find. And so I wrote about them almost as like x-rays of an emerging culture, and I was just fascinated that you could do that, and by the idea that childhood might vary from one culture to the next, or one time in history to the next. And then I just kind of put it all aside in my mind for a while and went off to the Iowa Writers' Workshop to write poetry for 2 years. While I was there, I happened to go into a bookstore and see a picture book on the wall. It was Nancy Burkhardt's illustrated edition of Snow White. And just as a civilian, someone who likes, you know, visual things, I was bowled over by the exquisite art in that book. And it began to make me think about the quality of art that you might find in a children's book, and why, you know, you didn't hear about that very much or see that kind of art in museums. So then I bought the book, but I put that thought aside. And then a couple years later, I found myself working at Dover Books in New York as a copywriter. But by chance, Dover had a list of facsimile reprints of early English and American children's books for collectors. And when I left my lowly job 3 years later, my boss asked me if I wanted to write the introduction to the next book in that series. So suddenly I had a publication in the field. And then I was living in the village and wanting to be a writer, not knowing what I wanted to write about. So a subject, you know, it was sort of reconnecting with my college interest, and I was beginning to think maybe I could write something about this. And it was at that moment that I was in another bookstore and found a book I'd never heard of called Goodnight Moon. And I thought, I was very struck by the poetry of it. So my Iowa experience was coming into play, and my childhood love of biography and my adult wish to be a writer all converged in the thought that possibly I would write a biography of the author of this extraordinary poem that a 2-year-old could understand. And that's what I did. And 10 years later, my book was published.
So, and the interest in children's literature and art has manifested and continued in a lot of ways as a trustee for the Eric Carle Museum, which has taken a very unique place in the world of children's art, and also in judging contests. What have you been interested to see in the evolution of children's art?
Let's see. It's been interesting to see how the field of illustration has changed from one that artists up until, say, 30 or so years ago were apt to find their way into by chance, into a field that young artists today make their destination, you know, from an early time in their education. I think it's gained a great deal in status and become much closer to the mainstream of art making than it was in the past. So one consequence of that, of course, is that more very talented people enter the field than ever before. It probably also has a dark side in that it tends to favor artists who are fully formed at the beginning, which makes it harder for somebody like Marie Sendak, who took a little time to develop, to find a place, because the publishers are so glad to meet somebody who already has a very established style. But as printing technology has evolved, I think the tools that are available to artists have greatly expanded, and those who are sensitive and knowledgeable enough to use them well. Like, full color was a great luxury 25 years ago, but now it's taken for granted. It means that the palette has just expanded, so the possibilities are probably greater than ever. So that would be another change. And then I think as the culture has become more saturated with images, the assumption about what children are capable of absorbing or understanding visually has probably enlarged, so that there's a wider range of emotion and style coming into children's books than was probably the case in the past. So, but for the fact that there are tremendous commercial pressures to whip out books that may not really be ready to be published, which is a tremendous, I think, liability of this time, the opportunities to do wonderful things are probably greater than they ever have been.
So with that, when you have, there's the commercial aspect, for one thing, there's changing media in another aspect of it. Do you think there's a tendency to want to play to the adults of the industry as opposed to the children?
Oh yeah, and I'm sure that's increased for the simple reason that the market has shifted in the last 30 or so years away from the library world, where you had very knowledgeable purchasers of books who were aware of the tradition and had, you know, for better or worse, their own strong ideas about what was good, not always bad, not always good either, as opposed to how things are now, where the market is more tilted toward the retail market, which consists of parents and presumably grandparents who really don't have much of a background knowledge, aside from whatever they remember from their own childhoods, to draw upon when they go into a big, chaotic, you know, chain store, most likely, and make a quick purchasing decision. And the result of that is that books have had to become advertisements for themselves in a way that they didn't have to be before. So they tend to become flashier, bigger, more gimmicky, and sometimes that adds to the fun of the book in a way that's appropriate and theatrical and, you know, and great, but more often than not, probably, it leads to books that are sort of gratuitously fancy and to the neglect, often, of the core feeling, which is what a child really craves when he or she is opening a book, I would say.
What about, that brings up the question of packaging. What's changed in the years about packaging? Because obviously we're needing to look across an awfully big store. Mm-hmm. And
Even if you just limit the comparison to the 90s versus now, 2008, the 90s was a time when there were still a lot of independent children's bookstores in the United States. And what that meant was you had individuals within each store, the owners and their employees, who tended to be very well informed about the new books and also pretty well informed about their customers. So when a new book came along, they could hand sell the book or recommend it in a personal way to a particular customer. So there was a really great and very intimate matching system between books and children going on. Those stores have largely disappeared, not completely, but largely they have, to be replaced by large, primarily, you'd have to say, impersonal stores where the parents are left to their own devices. And in that situation, the publishers have had to respond by adding on all these little gimmicky things to try to differentiate one book from the mass of the competition. I'm sure this has fueled the sort of frenzy about publishing celebrity books by movie stars and people like and rock stars whose names are very well known and loved, by a certain demographic, And if I were a parent who knew nothing about a book, books, and was going in with a little child, yanking on my arm with a few minutes to spend on choosing a book, I might very well gravitate toward those books too. I mean, why not? But of course, those books aren't very often very good. So it creates a kind of false, a kind of inefficiency in terms of getting really good, the right books to the right children. And I think there's a tremendous amount of that going on now, one way or another. Not all celebrity books, but that, in a way, is the most conspicuous example of a larger phenomenon. I think publishers really scared, that the books they do are only going to be on the shelves of these really big stores for a short time, and they're worried about, throwing their money into them and then having the money go to waste, and maybe their jobs will then be on the line if it happens too often. So they, you see more and more tinsel on the outsides, on the covers. You see bigger formats, larger shaped books, so they're just more of a physical presence on the shelf. You see brighter colors. I mean, it's really a shame that what has been what I call the quiet book has mostly disappeared, which is a book that is maybe illustrated in black and white or more subdued colors, as it would be appropriate to a book which is about, a dreamy or, less frenetic kind of mood or situation. I mean, surely there's room in life for that too. And there are many children who are like that, and I know I was. I used to like to stare at the wall when I was a child and just watch the kind of patterns form in my eyes, kind of a Zen kind of experience. lots of kids are like that. And you don't need to have red flashed at you all the time, but that's really the way things have gone, so it's a shame because there's a part of reality being left out because of that, that children would be glad to have included in their lives if they could.
I know Tommy DiPaolo talked to me about that one time where he talked about, the time spent staring up at clouds instrumental. Sure. Let me ask you another question about, you talked about the stores, like large stores and that, but now we're also buying online, so we've dropped to thumbnail images. What about that part?
Online book buying is great if you know what you're looking for. It's so efficient and so easy. I've really fallen for that completely. I don't know that it's much better or worse than, going into a store where nobody can help you. In the earlier years of Amazon, they had very good reviews, staff written reviews, and they still, publish some of the journal reviews, so I guess those can be helpful. I never have found the reader reviews that people write in. That seems more like fan mail, and you never know. It's so spotty, that I don't consider that very reliable as a guide to anything. I wish the independent stores could come back, or there could be more reviewing, because I don't really that's accessible to the public, because there isn't really that much. And I've never understood why there's so many magazines for women, and particularly for mothers, that don't see it as part of their mission or job to help educate their readers about the books that the mothers say they want for their children. Now, there's a real gap in America as far as getting reliable information out about children's books. I've never understood that.
Yeah, but you've done that for, in many ways, for Parenting Magazine.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and Parenting started in 1987, in pretty much the same month as Child Magazine started. At that time, Parents Magazine had been in existence for 60 years. That goes back to the 1920s. So there was this cluster of three, and Parenting and Child both were sort of new wave magazines in the sense that they assumed their readers were a little more educated than had been traditional for Parents Magazine, which is probably true, and that they would therefore be more book-oriented. So space was set aside on a regular basis in both magazines for book reviews. In the meantime, you know, 21 years later, Child has recently gone out of business, and the reviews in Parenting have gotten shorter and shorter. So, and I noticed that the magazines were growing toward each other in various ways, which I think is what happens. And there's the search for the common denominator of readership, which I think is assumed to translate as the biggest possible circulation, you know. And so, you know, Parenting is still hanging on with book reviews, but it isn't really solving America's need, you know, serving America's need in the way that I would wish it could be served, you know. And literary magazines like The New Yorker and The Atlantic, which, I mean, The Atlantic in the 19th century had lots of space for children's book reviews, and so did The Nation. It was considered a part of nation building in those days to educate the younger generation by letting the parents know what good books were out there. Somehow or other, you know, serious literary magazines have just dropped that as a goal, and I think it's foolish because, I mean, who's going to be reading their magazines in 40 years? You know, if nobody makes readers now, you know, but it's just not a priority for whatever reason in our country.
I guess we can ask that about a lot of different areas if kids aren't reading. What about when you're looking at what you've just done, the history of children's literature going back. I mean, there have been all kinds of moments. What for you were some of the standout moments where you really saw a ground shift?
Sure. Well, very often it seems the ground shifts come after major wars. After the Civil War, Americans, I think, were so horrified by what had happened and so shaken in their confidence about moral certainty that they moved away from making books for children, which presented very clear-cut ideas about what was right and what was wrong. The books before that, with some exceptions, but the majority of books in the early 19th century and before had been about the good child and the bad child. It was very clear who was who, and they were all about telling you what path to follow in life, whether it was how to conduct yourself in this life or how to prepare yourself for the next life. There were shades of difference in that regard in terms of your philosophy or religion, but the underlying moral certainty was rock solid. After the Civil War, people really, I think, didn't know and realized they didn't know, and it opened up a lot of publishers and parents to fiction, to storytelling, which of course is a kind of lie, you know, whether for the purpose of entertainment or for the purpose of entertaining possibilities which the real world does not yet contain. So there was a real renaissance, or not a renaissance, but a sense. It wasn't a return to. It was a first birth of fiction for children in America. And of course, you had people like Louisa May Alcott writing then, and Mark Twain, and Frank Stockton, and any number of others. And that was the age of the great children's magazines, St. Nicholas being the most famous. And very often, those magazines were owned by book publishers, and the book people would use the magazines as sort of laboratories or proving grounds in which to discover talent. And then when someone really good came along, artist or writer, then books would follow. So Scribner, Harper, and Houghton Mifflin, what was then the company that preceded Houghton Mifflin, all had magazines and used them as kind of generators, like engines of creativity. So that was one big change. And then Carnegie, you know, at the turn of the century, gave a lot of money for public libraries all over America. And one of the features of those libraries was a special room devoted to children. And that was a new idea in the world at that time. There was no other country that had children's rooms or children's library service. And there had been a debate among the American librarians about whether that was a good idea or not, because, you know, kids are noisy, they have sticky fingers, etc. And I think they also weren't sure whether it was the government's role, you know, or it was a public function to provide for children, or whether that was something that parents would rather do on their own. But the consensus emerged by around 1900 that libraries did have a role to play. And it was really part of the progressive reform movement, you know, ending child labor, getting better health care for children, and getting better, you know, getting better access to books and education. So once that started, publishers, you know, stood at attention and saw that there was a new market, very well-defined market, coming into being. Then World War I came along and got in the way because it interrupted everything. But after that war, that's when the publishing companies in New York and Boston responded with great enthusiasm by creating independent divisions devoted to children's book publishing. So from that moment on, there were specialists in the publishing world who could speak to the specialists in the library world, and together they sort of decided what they considered good books for children. And for the next, you know, 70 years, they were the American world of children's books, those two partners, really. At that time, you know, the Newbery Medal was created, and that was part of the same push toward raising the quality of books by, you know, rewarding someone each year for doing something great and giving everyone else, you know, a carrot to kind of strive toward. And also as a signal to parents as to what they might want to buy when they went into the store. And then the Caldecott Medal followed, you know, 15 years later for illustration, its counterpart for illustration. It was also just after World War I that the Hornbook was founded. So that was the first magazine in the world that published nothing but reviews and articles about children's books. So it was another, you know, aspect of what was emerging as a really coherent system for making books, bringing them out into the world and helping people, discriminate. So that was another big turn. And then after World War II, the baby boom just caused an explosion in interest among publishers, because there was so many children and so much money to be made. And it led publishers to look for ways to reach larger and larger numbers of children, as opposed to just the elite 10 or 20% that had been served up until that time. So anyway, those are a few examples.
So what about, where are we at now? In what you're seeing happening, there's certainly a lot going on with media.
Yeah. Well, you know, in recent years, there's been consolidation both of the book-selling industry and the publishing industry. So you have fewer and fewer companies selling to fewer and fewer other bookseller companies. I think it's led to some extent to a narrowing of the market, because both the major booksellers and the major publishers are looking for sure things. So because it's so unpredictable, there's so many people, there's so many books, and you never know when your company is going to be bought out or split apart or whatever. So to minimize the growing risk of being in this business at all, which was never a high profit business, the people who have emerged as the stars, you know, like Eric Carle, for instance, are viewed as the ones that publishers can rely on to help keep their business going. And so while I think there's always a search for new talent, the new talent probably has to fend for itself to a large extent. And a lot of the marketing, I believe, goes toward a relatively small number of books. And celebrity books, you know, get undue support because they represent a known or sure thing in a slightly different sense. In a very different sense, because Eric Carle knows what he's doing and Madonna may not know what she's doing, but they have something in common. They're both knowns in a world full of unknowns and risk. So that's part of what's happening. And then, of course, there are new media coming along and people once again talking about the book as possibly something which may disappear, which I don't really expect to happen, simply because it works so well and it's efficient and it's relatively, it affordable, I think, to most people in one format or another. And it's a great experience. You know, if you're reading a picture book with a little child on your lap, that beats, you know, staring at a screen. So, and people know that, or they will know that if they ever have the chance to experience it. So I think books are going to maybe be one of, you know, books have moved away from the center of our culture, but they still have a real part in our culture, in the same way that when TV was invented, it didn't kick radio out the door, but it's just one, so it's one more thing, one more way of getting information or entertainment. I think books will continue for some time. And I also think that some of the big companies may split up because they're so inefficient. And it could be, as has happened in the past, there were big companies by 19th century standards in the 19th century that split up and reconfigure themselves in different ways. You know, one partner went off and started a new company. And I think we might be ready for that to happen again. And that could lead to a new period of creativity. And while I don't certainly feel like I know that much about it, it seems to me the internet offers a lot of opportunities to solve the marketing problem. I mean, anybody can publish a book now. I mean, the technology to actually make the physical object is really very accessible and affordable. And the big thing is, how do you reach your audience? But with the internet, it seems to me there's got to be new and possibly effective ways of doing that too. So I actually think that for years publishers have been trying to get rid of authors, and it's going to end up that the authors will get rid of the publishers. That would be sort of a poetic justice.
No, I know it has been interesting to watch that dynamic. It certainly is a push-pull dynamic that's gone on for a long time. What about, last question, what about globally? What is happening in that way? I mean, are we becoming more homogenized or the opposite, do you think?
Well, it's from what I hear, American publishers are more reluctant than in past times to buy books from other countries. And one reason or rationalization that I've heard is that the sales and marketing people, who in recent years have had a lot more say in what gets published than in the past, when it would be the editor who was king or queen, you know. The marketing salespeople say that it's harder to sell a book when the author or artist isn't nearby to promote it in some way. You could say that because of the internet, they're just as close as anybody else, you know, but that they don't make that argument. I think there's sort of it may not be xenophobia, but I think certainly in the last several years, the administration in Washington has set a tone of turning our backs to the rest of the world, and because of the fragility of the industry as a whole, the chanciness of it all, I think that. The fear of the unknown as, you know, the foreign book just it plays into all that and makes publishers more averse to taking a chance on something from somewhere else. On the other hand, you know, there are little oases of hope in the form of a publishing company like Kane Miller, which has made it its mission to publish picture books from around the world in the U.S. And while I've been here at Bologna, I've met a woman from New Zealand who's doing exactly the same thing. She has a little house called Gecko Press, which just opened up, and she's actually partnering with Kane Miller on some projects. And I see more very vibrant publishing going on in France, for example, and it seems like there's more in Spain than there used to be. And I met a woman yesterday, a young woman from Romania, who must be in her 30s at the most, and grew up, I guess, under Ceausescu and the aftermath of that, which has been a real downer. You know, there's been nothing going on in the last few years for children's books. But she's determined not only to start it up again, but also to rediscover some of the books that were put out of print. In some cases, obliterated. The art was destroyed. And to rekindle the culture of publishing for children in her country, and I think she's going to do it. She's a very, you know, persuasive, energetic person. So I'm hoping that you know, America will open itself up a little more to books from other countries. The graphic novel has been maybe the biggest foot in the door recently, because such great things are coming from France, among other places. So, and there's such a powerful audience for that, that it doesn't, and Japan too, of course. So the, you know, there's a kind of magnetic pull of bringing those books into the country, despite what anybody thinks. But maybe it'll become broader, and people will really get interested in, I mean, your multiculturalism that goes beyond, you know, tacos and rice, you know, you know, but really with a real curiosity about what other people in other parts of the world think and feel about things. That's what I'd like to see.
And maybe we'll have a chance to learn more from our history, too, when we've probably seen some of those kinds of things happen in cycles, too. Well, Leonard, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you. This has really been enjoyable.